This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Unlike other cities, Charlotte has prided itself as being somewhat above the fray because it knew how to deal with controversy, unrest, and social change. We did it the Charlotte way. Perhaps you've heard that phrase bandied about as people coped with the shock that came from witnessing the riots following the Keith Scott shooting. Rioting in the streets isn't how we handle things. It isn't the Charlotte way. So what is the Charlotte way? It's an unwritten code as mythical as it is ill-defined. It's also not the way to handle the undercurrent of anger and dissatisfaction unearthed by the recent protests. At least that's the opinion of two of this city's most effective leaders, Hugh McCall and Harvey Gantt. Hugh McCall is, of course, the former CEO of Bank of America, who is responsible for just about everything you see uptown, and who some say, or some believe, is one of the people who created the Charlotte Way years ago. We'll ask about that as Mr. McCall joins us for the hour, along with former Charlotte Mayor Harvey Gantt, who told other city leaders recently that the city must address the cancerous effects of racism if we want to stave off future demonstrations in our streets. We're going to spend an hour talking about exploring that admonition and other ways to move forward and away from the Charlotte way with both of our guests this morning, Hugh McCall and Harvey Gantt. Welcome back to the program to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
I want to point out that this was supposed to be on the air yesterday, but we had a technical glitch, so we are taping this. So some of the things that we may talk about today may be 24 hours out of date. But I do want to talk just briefly about what happened on Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock. Charlotte City Council went into special session to respond to a 1 a.m. Tuesday night or Wednesday morning criticism from the state legislature, who is scheduled to go into session Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock. They wanted to repeal HB 2 because Charlotte finally decided to repeal the city's ordinance that led to HB 2, but evidently they didn't repeal all of it. Both of you have experience in dealing with city and state government. And I know you don't know all the particulars of this because you're not involved in this, but just from your point of view, what's going on?
You know, that's a tough question. If you asked me based on my own experience with the legislature when I was mayor, and you got to put this in perspective, that's 30-some years ago. A lot of what you did was based on trust. I mean, between the two bodies. You know, we start with our local delegation, and we try to engender this element of trust. We didn't always agree, but you trusted the instincts of the other side in terms of or what they were in for. When I look at a lot of what I see today, I don't see that level of trust between the two bodies.
Is that because when you were mayor, it was the Democratic city government and a Democratic legislature?
I suspect that had a lot to do with it. But even then, we had conservative Democrats, moderate, and liberal Democrats. Yeah. So while we didn't distinguish along party lines as well defined as we have today, there was not a monolithic Democratic Party in the General Assembly, and even on my council, we had Republicans and Democrats of different persuasions. But you had to begin to have the trust that what we were trying to do was for the good of Charlotte and that we could convince the legislature even when Charlotte didn't have the best of reputations in the General Assembly, that what we did in Charlotte, if it was good for Charlotte, it had to be good for North Carolina.
Yeah.
So
you were one of the great leaders of the city and still remain an incredible influence in what goes on here. I know people seek you out, Mr. McCall, all the time for your opinion, and you built Nations Bank, NCNB Nations Bank, into the one of the biggest banks in the country, with doing business all over the world with Bank of America. Put what's going on here in North Carolina and around the country into some sort of perspective, because as the head of Bank of America and as the head of its predecessor, Nations Bank, you really broadened the scope of protections and welcoming people of diverse backgrounds before you bought the Bank of America in San Francisco. You did that before you did that.
Well, actually long before, Mike. I got most of my training on that sensitivity in the United States Marine Corps, where we believe everybody pulls their pants on the same way, and we ran our company that way. Now, I'm like Harvey. I mean, I got along fine with the legislature when I was running the bank, primarily because all I ever asked for was something for my city. Mm-hmm. In other words, we were a national bank. We really didn't need laws or permissions from the state capitol, so I never went there on business for my company. I always went there for something that mattered to Charlotte. What I think we're seeing is just a reflection of what's going on nationally is populism coming from both the left and the right. And somehow Charlotte has become – we represent the ends, apparently, or we represent the enemy for some unknown reason. And while we are still the economic engine of the state and we're still providing a huge amount of the revenue of the state in terms of income taxes, sales taxes, et cetera. So I don't – I mean, you can't make a case for the enmity, but it's there.
Because you've called HB2 inappropriate legislation, and you said this before, it really proved to hurt North Carolina, but you said it will hurt North Carolina, and it turns out to have done so, given the pullout of business and the pullout of sporting and events and other events around the state. That didn't seem to make a difference. You're a businessman. Does it make a difference?
It makes a huge difference, and it will make a difference to the state. And when you lose jobs, it affects everybody in the state. I mean, it affects the people seeking jobs. It hurts in terms of tax revenues. It hurts in every way possible. And our reputation has been badly damaged. And candidly, we're going to spend a lot of time trying to repair that. It doesn't take long to destroy a reputation.
If there's blame to place for the last year of what we've gone through, where does it lie or lay? Where should we place this blame?
There was a huge overreaction to the Charlotte Ordinance by some powerful leaders in the General Assembly.
Was it necessary to begin with?
Absolutely not. I think they overreacted.
No, I mean it was the ordinance necessary to begin with.
Yes, okay. Yes, I thought so.
Okay.
And I suppose I'm colored by the fact that I'm one of the minorities in this country. And I keep going back to if you took LGBTQ out of this and stuck in African Americans and said, okay, Harvey, we will give you the right as a African American to eat at a five and dime store in downtown Charlotte, but we're not going to give you the right to go to school without children. Mm-hmm. You'd be treating me in an impartial way. And in this particular case, the LGBTQ community was basically saying that we simply want to have the rights that anybody else has. Now, some people disagree with the whole business of whether people who are transgender are mentally unbalanced or all the other kinds of excuses people come up with. But in my opinion, the problem that they reacted to, the General Assembly did, reacted to, I think, was blown out of proportion in the fact that so many other cities and states across the nation allow those laws to be carried out, and it has never produced any kind of issue that anybody could ever bring forth. And so I thought there was an overreaction. I think they miscalculated the impact that it might have on business and job development and so forth and so on. And it was done so hastily that it almost predicted that because you did it in haste, you didn't consider all the other factors. I thought the governor overreacted. I think he could have at least tested the waters and seen, or at least said, wait a minute, folks, let's take a look at this. Let's be more deliberate in what we're doing. Let's see what the impact of a law that really kind of went way beyond bathrooms access. So, yeah, there was an overreaction, in my opinion. And if you ask me to place the blame, I would have to say that I think the General Assembly has to take responsibility.
Well, I want to point out again that we're having this conversation at 9 o'clock on Wednesday morning, and by 9 o'clock on Thursday morning, when this is heard by our listening audience, we'll know a lot more about what happened at the Charlotte City Council meeting and in the legislature today. But I have Hugh McCall and Harvey Gantt with me today to talk about something else, because this has been a tumultuous year for the nation and particularly for Charlotte, given HB 2, and also the aftermath of the shooting of Keith Scott. And when he was shot by police and the riots ensued, a lot of people said, well, this is just not the Charlotte way. Charlotte has this reputation of handling these tough situations in a different, more genteel – we just get it done. Are you one of the people who came up with the Charlotte way years ago, Mr. McCall?
I actually don't know what it means. But so the answer is no. Whatever I learned about Charlotte, I learned here as a young man watching other people do things. There were people at Ivy's and Belk's and all the banks that were providing leadership for the city, and I watched what they did, and I learned from them. So I guess it's an osmosis that I picked it up on. And the way we do things is talk to each other. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
Walking down the street and saying, why don't we do X or why don't we do Y? And we've always had good leadership here and in every phase of our development. And so really Harvey and I have a long connection because when he became mayor the same year that I became chairman of the bank. And together we did a lot of things, and that's because we shared a dream about this city. So I don't know what the Charlotte way is, but the way I think of it is talking to each other.
Let me interject here before you ask that next question. I arrived in Charlotte in 1965, and in 1968, some civil rights leaders had their homes bombed.
Yeah.
That was a seminal moment for this city, and I observed some very clear things. One, the mayor at that time got out front and said, you know, that's not who we are. That's not the kind of city we are. And he pulled together the black and the white community, and they had some big affair at one of the big venues in town. Can't remember whether it was Ovens Auditorium or the Coliseum at that time. And then I reflected back on the fact that when all of the social issues in the South, and the South was in turmoil at that time because it was undergoing this change. The civil rights movement was really coming to maturity. And lots of cities were having struggles dealing with that. Birmingham, lots of cities in the South, you know, were making front page news. And I observed, even as a young architect moving into this town, how quickly people like Stan Brookshire, the mayor, and the chairman of the chamber and business leaders got together and said, you know, we got to do something about that. We can't have that in Charlotte. Business and the welfare of the city was far more important than being resistant to social change that was clearly coming.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I read that. And I saw those folks get together, integrate the lunch counters voluntarily. We never had a major social conflagration over that. You didn't see those kinds of things in the street. And so Charlotte got the reputation of being this moderate city that where business really was very important and so forth and so on.
So like Atlanta, which called itself the city too busy to hate, that is the Charlotte way, to talk it out and avoid these confrontations. We're coming right back on Charlotte Talks.
More of our conversation with Hugh McCall and Harvey Gantt on the Charlotte way in just a moment here on Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and CFA Society North Carolina, hosting their annual forecast dinner Tuesday, January 10th. Providing education and support to North Carolina's investment professionals. Information and registration at cfanorthcarolina.org. On the local news roundup, the impasse over the repeal of HB 2 is broken, only to hit another impasse, one that looks to both sides like a double cross. The Charlotte School of Law is in the middle of yet another crisis. Governor McCrory diminishes the power of his successor, Roy Cooper, by signing House Bill 17 into law. And the Charlotte City Council votes to lobby for subpoena power for the Police Review Board, an issue that came up following the Keith Scott shooting. Those stories and more with a roundtable of reporters when Charlotte Talks tomorrow morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President-elect Donald Trump has promised to use his executive authority to overturn countless laws and federal regulations. Understanding the power and limits of today's executive branch.
That conversation on the Diane Rehm Show following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. I'm here today with Hugh McCall, former chairman and CEO of Bank of America, chairman and co-founder of Falfurrious Capital Partners, and Harvey Gantt, former Charlotte mayor, two of our civic leaders. We're talking about the Charlotte Way, which seemed to fail us in the aftermath of the shooting of Keith Scott. And after the Charlotte Way, after that shooting, people said that the Charlotte Way was about talking things out. And now time has come to stop talking and to start doing something. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think we need to talk to different people. I think what we have thought is that we were all talking, that we were all thinking about all the problems, but we weren't. I mean, in other words, there was a tremendous buildup of steam, of frustration, and in some cases, hopelessness, and that we just weren't paying attention. And so now we are paying attention, and we have a huge number of people that are of goodwill actually doing a lot of talking with each other, but we still need to address the problems. The problems are economic. The problems are housing. It's always been education, but we've been throwing money at education for years. So it's not just money. It's going beyond that. It's looking at outcomes and seeing if we are actually doing the right thing. But what we need is action. For instance, when I remember when I was running the bank, we had a need for about 10,000 homes, affordable homes that we didn't have. And today that number is 25,000 to 30,000 somewhere. And in other words, we've been working on this problem for 25 years or so and 30 years, and the problem's gotten larger. Well, we need to quit talking about it and do something about it. So there's a lot going on around that area.
You think part of the problem is that much of this is invisible to a lot of people? I mean, District Attorney Andrew Murray, who, when he declined to press charges against the officer who shot Mr. Scott, saying that it was completely lawful, he quoted people exclaiming that this isn't Charlotte. He was talking about that after the riots. But Mr. Murray contends that it's high time that all of us recognize that this is Charlotte and that not everyone experiences the same Charlotte. But is that because people in South Charlotte, in Ballantyne, in South Park, Myers Park, never see the other side of Charlotte?
Mike, I think you're hitting on something, and I've been struggling with it myself. I think I shared with some folks back in October at the Chamber retreat that one of the surprising things to me was how little I recognized a lot of the folks who were in the street protesting. I didn't know those folks. I thought I used to know all of the people who were doing various things in various communities across all socioeconomic levels. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know them. And part of that could have been because I'm getting older and I'm off the scene. So, you know, I will submit to some of that. So I didn't know the folks who were protesting. But I think I understood something about what's been going on with regard to the various, the ladder of socioeconomic development, from people at the very bottom to the people at the top. And I think the city got a clue of what the situation was with the Opportunity Task Force that we ultimately formed, because there was something that came out that said if you were born poor in this town,
yes,
the promise of America is never going to be made real to you.
Well,
reaching that level.
We're one of the cities in that study that said if you are born poor, you're staying that way. You are not going to get out of it in Charlotte.
And I suspect that that is part of where the problem is, that there's a lot of anger out there, and it's fueled by seeing situations in other parts of the country also. I think Charlotte doesn't exist in a vacuum. So when the cops shot Mr. Scott, it fueled a reaction that's brought that anger to the surface.
And we also have a lot of newcomers who don't understand Charlotte or the Charlotte way. And we also, let me ask you this. Do you think we have a vacuum of leadership here? Because there was a time, Mr. McCall, you were part of this. You and Ed Crutchfield and Rolf Neal and several other people were part of this group of people who court has sort of made the decisions. We see a problem, we're going to fix it. We're going to get together, we're going to fix it. That doesn't happen anymore.
Well, I don't know if that's actually accurate that it doesn't happen anymore. I've had my eyes opened since this matter, and I'll be very candid. I had a view that the African Americans that had prospered and moved into middle and upper middle income areas had not helped reach back and tried to help. Well, I found that not to be true. For instance, I met a group called the Young Black Men Leadership Institute, run by John Martin, and I see the young people involved in mentoring other young people, that is young people in college, mentoring high school and elementary school kids. There are over 200 kids involved in that right now. And so they are making their way out. They're getting educated. And so I've seen a lot of good work. The Women's Intercultural Group is an excellent group of people. And I keep running into people that really are making a difference. So I feel better about that than I did before seeing before the riots. Let me put it that way.
But how does that square with your saying that we're dealing with prejudice that takes the form of not caring? Obviously, there are people who are caring.
Yes, well, you know, I admit to being wrong sometimes. And I have a lot of opinions unencumbered by facts. But what I'm telling you is I've been out gathering facts and meeting people that are making a difference. So things are going on. We just need to expedite them. One of the things that I'm working on right now and with Rick Elias and with Kathy Bassan over at the Bank of America, I should say, we're working on trying to get a group of companies to agree to be off-takers of high school graduates here who are not going to college. Give them a job, train them, give them an income that takes them out of poverty and sets them on their way. So, I mean, there are things that can be done that haven't been done. Now, yes, I do believe we have a large part of our population that suffers from an absence of information. And that's because people get into they ride to work, they go home to their neighborhood, they don't look in other neighborhoods, they never see it. They don't see the poverty, they don't see the problem, and so they're not aware of it.
Let's be a little bit more candid about this. The problems 30 years ago, 35 years ago, while they might have been hard, were solvable through legislation. A lot of the demonstrations and arrests that occurred in the 60s and the 70s were based on the whole system of destroying legal segregation. Mm-hmm. And we had the notion that if we had things like the war on poverty and we community development block grant programs to rebuild neighborhoods, that this would start to solve our problem. The frustration that occurred as a result of those efforts when we didn't solve all those problems had to do with the fact that while legal segregation is gone in this country forever, and while we've done things all the way to electing an African-American president, people don't see that kind of sea change in attitude or latent racism or institutional racism or just people being benign to some of the issues that are out there that still anger people. And I can't say enough about this whole notion that if I'm born poor in Charlotte and I can't get out of that trap, how that causes a kind of anger that might even be different than the days when we had legal segregation.
Why do you think it is true that if you are born poor in Charlotte, you can't get out of it?
I think we are all kind of flummoxed by what it is that we really need to do. Do we need to do more in the area of education? He's already said, you know, we spent a lot of money trying to educate people in this community to make sure that they had a chance at a 21st century economy job. And we probably will still do that. But everything from attitudes to the feeling that people don't care or don't know about my issues, the fact that that there are still structural problems existing amongst minority families in this country, where the men can't find work, or kids coming out of high school, a male might have a difficult time finding a decent job. This is why I'm intrigued by the notion that we ought to pay a lot more attention to what happens to high school graduates and whether they become usable in an economy that requires different kinds of skills. This might allow people to get a job, because when you've got a job, particularly as a male in this society, right, you've got the potential to do a lot of things to change your attitude about what America is all about. And what that hope that my parents had back in the 40s fueled something different. But my dad had a job, and he had an eighth grade education, and he was able to educate five kids, send them all to college. I look at that same family today with that level of education, and they're not going anywhere. They're going to be stuck in that.
But that's true of white families, too.
But that's what I'm saying. This thing is much more complex.
Yeah. So the easy problems
we've solved the easy problems.
Yeah.
Now we got to drill deeper to get at it, and I don't pretend to have what the answers are going to be.
There are a lot of people who are frustrated about this educational component in this, because you're right. We have thrown millions of dollars at education, and it doesn't seem to make all that much of a difference. We're still graduating kids out of high school who can't read and write at an eighth grade level, and they have to get remedial education, and that's just inexcusable to me, at least it is. And if you're going to provide a free education from grade kindergarten through 12, a lot of people think you ought to avail yourself of that opportunity, and it isn't happening in many cases. Why not?
Well, we all know the answer to that. I mean, the issue is at the home level. It's what's happening at home. When you leave the school, what happens at home? Are you encouraged to read? Are there books to read? Are you connected to Wi-Fi? I mean, in a world in which the whole world's connected, is your house connected? I mean, these are questions, do you even own the devices to get on the Internet? I mean, these are all issues. They're socioeconomic issues that are very real and affect a broad part of our population, both of all races. But there is this latent racism, and there's no question about it. And we're talking to each other about it in any event. This is one of the good things that is coming out of it. I know my church is engaged in talking with this issue, with the Women's Intercultural Exchange is meeting in our church. And we're talking over a series of meetings open to the public to just talk about all the issues that we have.
But a lot of people don't see racism. A lot of white people don't see racism. There's an article in the New York Times where they talked to voters, and a lot of those voters who voted in this last election felt that white people were being more discriminated against than African Americans. So that's a problem, too.
Well, I always, because I'm 81. I've been around a long time. And one of the beautiful things about being old is you get to look back over a long history. And I grew up in a segregated society. I know all about that. And I've seen it all change. Mm-hmm. Okay? It's been slow. It hadn't been fast. It's been a long, slow march. And what happened in the 60s and the 70s, men, white males, controlled the world. And they began to share a little bit of power. So they let women come into the workforce, and then they let African Americans come into the workforce, and they shared a little bit of power. Now, Harvey's already mentioned, we now have had an African American be president of the United States, and we've shared a lot of power. And the African American community has a huge voting capability and strength. And so we've shared a lot of power. What's really happened to the white community in this populist uprising is they feel, hey, we've We've been ignored now for 40 or 50 years, and we'd like to be in the game too. So the power has been shared so much that they feel they don't have it anymore. And that's one of the issues that is inherent in what we've seen happen in this year's politics.
And that's why it's so complex, because that's a part of it. But the other part of it is you can't move forward unless you recognize racism and admit to it. And you have suggested, Mr. Gant, that we have a reconciliation commission to address the effects of racism. Is this like the...
It's not an original idea,
but it came from South Africa.
You know, it came from South Africa, and it's actually a lot of the way I used to resolve problems within my own family. But you've got to admit, and I had four children, and when there were issues, we had to have a sit-down, and each side had to share their stories, and then we had to reconcile in such a way, and then we could move forward. I don't think we've ever done that in this country, not very well. I mean, slavery came to an end, bang, and then the African-American was said, go for it. No help, no admission of this wrong that was done. And that's come forward. And so a lot of white people are saying, you know, that's what my daddy did, or my great-great-great-granddaddy did. Don't blame that on me. But the fact is that the system is skewed in the direction of white folks. And in order for this to be addressed, you have to admit that there was something badly done to a whole race of people that has affected their psyche, affected the psyche of the whole country, and their attitude, and even who should dispense power.
Yeah.
You just said that. I mean, you know, we needed to distribute it. Who's we? We would have been the whole country. I made a joke the other day to some folks. What would have happened had my great-great-great-grandfather immigrated to the U.S. just like the folks from Ireland and other places? And we were just people of a darker hue, but we were there working in the factories and starting businesses and so forth and so on. How different would America have been had we not come over on ships
into
slavery? It would have been a different country.
Yeah.
So there's got to be an admission that we were wrong for doing it, and then the policies need to dig deeper. But that's where it's difficult. That's where I don't have the answer.
So we have about a minute left in this segment. Just help me out here, because you've talked about doing these commissions and having a safe place to honestly discuss on both sides what this all means, without risk of being called a wild-eyed liberal or a racist pig. So how do you do that? And if the Charlotte way is to talk it out, are you going to start this?
I think you have to start talking it out. And I think you have to start doing it in big and small ways. And what I mean by that is, yes, a bigger group of people meeting together with leaders from every sector of the community you can, and allowing people to come and express their honest opinions. I think a lot of white people in this community are never going to express their full feelings about things because they don't want to get up in a room and be vilified by a group of people who will call them racist.
Right.
And they have some legitimate concerns. But, you know, I ran a diverse architectural firm for years. I've gone into diverse settings for years, and I've seen discussions that don't start off talking about whether one's a racist or not, but starting off dealing with the humanity of people themselves.
I want to come back to that. Yeah. We have to take a break. We're talking with Harvey Gant, former mayor of Charlotte, and Hugh McColl, former chairman and CEO of the Bank of America. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Our conversation with Hugh McColl and Harvey Gant on The Charlotte Way continues in a moment here on Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and NC Warn, working to slow climate change by curbing methane emissions from fracked gas and power industries. Information at ncwarn.org. Support also comes from DHG, a public accounting firm based in Charlotte. The people of DHG work to combine global assurance, tax, and advisory resources with a commitment to help you and your business succeed. President-elect Donald Trump has promised to use his executive authority when he takes office next month to overturn countless laws and federal regulations. Coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, Diane Rehm and her guests will take a look at understanding the power and limits of today's executive branch. That's the Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
You probably noticed out and about in your seasonal shopping that different stores have different return policies. Turns out there is a reason for that.
There are a number of customers who are never going to take advantage of a return policy because they feel that it's morally, wrong. And then there are some people that no matter how strict you make it, they're going to find the loophole.
I'm Kai Rizdal. What kind of shopper are you? The story next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. In the aftermath of the Keith Scott shooting and the riots that followed, there was much gnashing of teeth about how we don't do things this way in Charlotte. We do things the Charlotte way, and perhaps it's time for a paradigm shift in how we do things to move things forward. And we're talking about that with Hugh McCall, former chairman and CEO of the Bank of America and chairman and co-founder of Falfurrious Capital Partners, still working. Never going to give it up. Mm-hmm. Harvey Gantt, also here, former Charlotte mayor. We were talking about your idea, Mr. Gantt, of having a reconciliation commission. There's danger in that, it seems to me, because a lot of people could be hurt or have their feelings hurt. And wouldn't that raise tensions?
Somebody once said that having a good argument where both sides get their feelings out on the table deepens relationships, can deepen relationships. If people were honest, if I knew how my neighbor felt about something, but I had to live next to that neighbor, we would keep talking. We would keep talking in a way that ultimately he starts to understand me and I start to understand him. And when I say, maybe the term reconciliation commission sounds a little bit too governmental. What I really mean is conversations that deal with an effort at reconciliation that starts with a level of honesty about what has occurred, that people shouldn't deny that the existence of this second-class status that started with slavery and has in many ways come forward to the day. And we shouldn't deny that there are reasons for white people to be concerned about what may be happening.
Well, I think that one thing, as you maybe don't hear, there are certainly a large number of white people whose families never owned any slaves and feel like, what are you talking to me about that for? I mean, now that's not me, but I admit that there are. And so you have to take account of the fact that some people think, wait a minute, my parents didn't have anything to do with that. In fact, they just got here one generation ago. For instance, just to illustrate, one of our leaders here in the city is of Scandinavian heritage, and they have nothing to do with it. No connection whatsoever. So, I mean, that's part of the issue, too. I mean, I think that there's some of that. I'm not saying that mitigates against the suggestion. I think it needs to happen. But at some point, we have to clear the air and move on. And that's the real question. We don't seem to be able to.
So how do we do that? Because we clearly have a problem. We have we have an economic problem. We have a social problem. We have problems with trust in the African-American community of police and vice versa, which is causing horrible problems. What do we do? Where do we go? If there's no such thing as the Charlotte way or the Charlotte way has failed us, what do we do? Because it could begin here. We're a forward-looking city.
Well, I think it's going on right this minute. I think the three men that are involved in One Charlotte, that is Eugene Ford, Jesse Curitan, and Brett Carter, are doing their best to get out in front of this and to create opportunity for people to talk to each other.
People may not know who those people are, but that's the Novant Health, Carolina's healthcare system, and the Bank of America, right?
Yes.
So once again, where maybe it used to be First Union, NCNB, the Charlotte Observer, and Jefferson Pilot Communications, now it's still big corporate titans doing this.
Yes, but I think they're doing this as because they are African-American males that see the need to provide leadership and to bring people together, and they have the intellectual capacity and, let's say, and, of course, the economic force to bring people together. And I think that's good. So, but it wasn't happening. So, I mean, you can't just write it off because it's a beginning. Now, is it the only answer? No, of course not.
But, and I think what I'm evolving to is that the conversations we're talking about need to occur at all levels. I'd like to see the evangelical right get together with the churches in this community and say, we're going to provide a safe place. Safe meaning, I'm not going to condemn you for your feelings. You can't condemn me for mine, but we're going to try to find some mutual landing place where we can begin to agree. I think churches need to get together to have that conversation. I think neighborhoods need to do that. Abutting neighborhoods need to do that. And they need to do it at different levels.
How do you do it?
And I don't think you can structure all of that. When you say, how do you do it? You know, some of this you can say, the mayor and the commission and the school board appoint people, the business leadership. You can do that. That's the easy one. Mm-hmm. The one that's tougher is, I want Plaza Midwood to talk to the folks who live in and can you neighborhood leaders get together and have some conversations about what we can do to be better neighbors? And sometimes I think when people get to talking, you know, I have neighbors on both sides of me that are diverse. And we don't go out in the backyard and talk about race.
No.
But we talk about how your children are doing in school. We talk about the struggles you have. And it's amazing the level of understanding and appreciation you get when people actually talk to each other.
But you cease to be the other.
Absolutely. People need to get to know each other and their aspirations. And, geez, they're just like us. They, you know. Yeah.
So clearly this is not linear because there's so many problems and there's so many pieces to this very complex puzzle. It's not we start with talk and then we move to this and then we move to that. It all has to happen at once. And you were talking about the need, Mr. McCall, for economic emancipation. And you've talked a little bit about encouraging businesses, particularly the big businesses, to bring young people into jobs, young people who are not headed to college.
Yeah.
So are you just talking to the big organizations? Are you talking to the smaller organizations? And if you bring young people in who are not headed to college, they're probably not headed to college because they didn't do well academically. Do they have the skills needed? And the other, not just how to run a computer, but how to interface with clients.
You make a presumption that maybe isn't so. In other words, they may not be going to college because they can't get any money. They can't afford it.
Right.
So, I mean, there's more than one reason for not going to college. And so yes, that's a problem, but it's a lot easier to train people and give them jobs than it is to arrest them and send them to prison. I mean, it's just crazy. And so, you know, you got to try everything, and that's one of the things that I think needs to be worked on. So I want to go back to meeting with each other. Our church is doing it. The churches all over town doing it. We're starting conversations. One of the and the more you talk to somebody, the easier, I agree with Harvey, the easier it is to get along. You find you're not that different. One of the things I'm the proudest of is Third and Fourth Ward and First Ward, because there we have integrated communities where people have chosen to live beside each other. Yeah. And they're fine. They don't have those kind of problems. They may have problems with traffic or something else, but they don't have problems. We don't have racial problems. That's not their issue. So I think that a lot of these things can be solved. But the big problem I see is that we have people who don't want to participate from both sides. And so what has always annoyed me is we'll have a meeting and we're going to talk about getting together. And what happens is a lot of good people of goodwill come together and we have a nice conversation, but nothing happens where it needs to happen.
Yeah. You're preaching to the choir.
Right, exactly. And so that part is something I'm very cynical about. And it's trying to get everybody to the table is hard.
Yeah.
Have them, we should try. And Harvey's right, the right answer is the faith community. And that's where we put down our weapons and come to church once a week and theoretically leave our prejudice at the
door. But the faith community is the most segregated. Sunday morning is the most segregated hour of the week.
which is why we have to start there.
Yeah,
and it's actually changing.
Yes,
it is. I'm amazed at some of the churches in this community, and maybe you all need to do a check on that.
Okay,
that are becoming increasingly more diverse. You know, one of them I think is with Elevation Church is growing.
Well, Covenant is
back.
For sure,
right?
And
they're enormous. Elevation Church is enormous.
This is another thing I need to say.
Okay,
my faith, and I tell my grandchildren this and my children this. My faith is that they can start to move this to another level. I'm a 74-year-old man, and he's a 81-year-old guy. I tell the young people, it's time for you to start to take charge of this and figure it out with all of the things at your disposal, social media and all the stuff that I have no idea of how to use. There are lots of ways to communicate today. And a lot of my hope is with the millennial crowd and the crowd coming behind and listening and eavesdropping on conversations amongst some of the younger people.
I'm not sure the millennials are the problem. I think it's the people in between you and them.
Yeah. Perhaps. I think that's right. I mean, I clearly agree with you. I don't see it with the young people, the really young people. Yeah. I think they have moved past race in a large way. Nevertheless, the system is still, as Harvey says, the system's still there. And until the system is broken or changed, it will always be there.
Let's talk about another problem that Charlotte has long faced, and that is the dearth of workforce or affordable housing. It's been going on for years, and it's probably getting worse as the area densifies and they're throwing up these apartments and apartment rents are rising, and now interest rates are rising, which is going to make the cost of homes a little more expensive going forward. Harvey, you have suggested that 10% of any new development should be set aside for affordable housing. You're an architect. I know you've worked on developments. I know you've worked with builders. Are they likely to want to do that?
No. I'll answer that question.
So how do you do it? Because if I'm wrong about this, correct me, please. But I don't think that the city of Charlotte has the power to pass an ordinance.
Absolutely.
That belongs at the legislature.
The legislature does not give the city of Charlotte the right to, for example, zone a piece of property and require that zoning deal with economics and social structure issues.
So how do you do it? Where do you begin?
Well,
two ways. Social pressure. If in fact we all agree we need to do this, that is, if we agree as a city, then the social pressure on the developers to do what's right will help. The second thing would be a little more what I would do if I were in charge, which is that we would look at your project and say, it's a really great project, and we'll get around to approving it. But, of course, if you were going to add this housing, we'd get to it sooner. Now, that's how I would handle it, but, of course, that's me.
Well, let me flip the coin. When you were chairman and CEO of Bank of America, would you have wanted or would you have put up with being told you have to put a branch in a lower socioeconomic area where there's likely not going to be many clients for your branch? How would you feel about that?
Well, we did it.
They did.
The answer is we did it, and we built housing in neighborhoods, and we never lost any money. In fact, you can talk to Kathy Bassad about this, but our Community Development Corporation actually had a better payment rate than our just general mortgage business did. So, you know, the facts are people that haven't had a home and get one, right, take care of it.
You talk about this whole issue of how we deal with the Charlotte Way. Mm-hmm. Well, the Charlotte Way would have been to sit down with developers in this community, and there are probably 10 to 12 of them that really are the big ones, and say, look, we got an issue. We got a problem. You're going into communities. You are rezoning property. You are buying up existing apartments, you're moving out folks to get the opportunity to charge higher rents in your newer developments, and you're hurting the city. You're hurting the city long term. You really need to do something about that. What I'm talking about is persuasive discussion that says, you can't continue to hurt our city this way. You're not helping our city. You're hurting them. By asking you, if you're building 300 units of housing, to put 30 affordable units in there, 30 affordable units where people are earning 60%, 80% of the monthly income, average monthly income in the city, that's a persuasive argument that I think the city council can make, in addition to using the weapon of zoning to say, look,
But will they? Because it strikes me that you gentlemen are from a generation and from a time in this country mm-hmm. when we were all in this together, and we had civic pride and we had and all that sort of thing going on. And today it seems as though that a lot of people don't want to make sacrifices. It's all about me, what I need, what I want, and I don't care about the rest of you. I got mine. I don't care about the rest of you.
Well, I'm not that negative about it. I think I see a lot of the young people really doing great things and making good things happen. And that starts from 18 or 20-year-olds I know that are doing great work in the Young Black Male Leadership Institute. I see it there. I see it with the 45, 55-year-old group of young people that I see contributing to a large number of things that are happening here in the city. So I'm not negative on that at all. I see it happening, that people gravitate to that. Yes, in the early years, people care about making money, building their own fortune, taking care of their family. But I see a lot of plowback, and I'm actually bullish on that side of it. So I want to make that clear.
I'm serving. I used to be a board member of the housing partnership that's built a lot of affordable units in this city. It started way back when I was mayor, and they've really done a huge amount of good in this area. I've also talked to developers in other cities that have done what I'm suggesting, the 10%. And I would argue that if we could get some of our developers to see those developments.
And with that, we are out of time.
We would be able to do more.
Thank you both. I hope you'll come back and talk more about this. Harvey Gantt, former Charlotte Mayor, Hugh McCall, former Chairman, CEO, Bank of America. Thank you both for the hour.
Thank you.